Hello everyone, and welcome to this first episode of the Pearson Future Tech for Education series on the EdTech podcast. My name is Sophie Bailey, and each week I'll be exploring the challenges and opportunities of future tech for education with contributors from across industry, research and academia. This week we set up the series by asking which future technologies for education should we consider as important, and how should we sensibly approach the impact of future technological change without being at once too cautious or too evangelist as educators. To help us navigate the myriad of information out there, here's Dennis Hurley, Director of Future Tech at Pearson. Welcome, Dennis.
Thanks, Sophie.
So I'm very excited to be working on this series together. The first episode is called What Does Future Tech for Education Look Like? What I was hoping to delve into in the beginning is thinking about which are the technologies that you think will have the most impact on education that we might be looking at throughout this series.
Sure. So there are a number of different ways to group emerging technologies, or exponential technologies, as they're sometimes called, when it comes to EdTech. Four foci, which is data science, which includes artificial intelligence, mixed reality, biosyncing, and human-machine relations.
So let's delve straight into some of those. So first up, mixed reality. What are the kind of applications you're seeing there for education?
So mixed reality, just to give that a little bit of an explanation, there are a number of terms that float around, is a spectrum of mixing virtual and physical interactions. On one end of the spectrum, we have tangible user interface. Think of that as just a mouse or a keyboard, where you're using mostly a physical object to interact with the digital object. Across the spectrum, you have augmented reality, which is a blend, almost could be 50-50 of virtual and physical. And then the other far end of the spectrum is fully immersive virtual reality, in which you're hardly even aware of your physical presence. Interaction between the physical and the virtual is best visualized on the reality-virtuality continuum, which was created by Paul Milgram from the University of Toronto about 20 years ago.
From your perspective, there's various discussions out there that I've seen around VR and AR and their application within education. What do you see as potentially some of the most useful? For example, I've spoken previously on the podcast about the use of simulation and VR around accessing either high cost or high risk learning experiences. Do you have a kind of view on where some of these technologies are most useful?
Absolutely. So when you're in a virtual reality experience, it feels real to you. If we give the learner a scenario and present them with experiences, it's almost as if it's real. So it helps memory retention. Let's say if you're describing the interior of the London Underground, it also encourages risk-taking, which is key to learning. Let's imagine you are in a language learning situation and you are encouraged to speak with another human. As we know, this sort of immersion is very useful in language learning. In virtual reality, there's less inhibition. There's less concerned about embarrassing yourself.
What's quite exciting, I know we're going to have a whole episode on language learning and how technology is changing that space, but also on the VR side, I think we're going to have some contributions from the HoloLens team who are working with surgical simulation environments. So how might you use VR to get yourself in a situation where you're learning surgical techniques without the perhaps increased risk? So different applications that we'll come to in the series as we move forward.
Excellent.
So next up, so data science and AI. So this will be hugely of interest, I'm sure, and lots of different interpretations of what this means. So what does that mean to you?
The reason I refer to data science and not just artificial intelligence is twofold. The first is it's a larger group of technologies and concepts than just artificial intelligence. It's about properly storing the data and properly understanding the data so it could be better used. Artificial intelligence is also a term that means different things to different people. It really is a program that can do something at human level. And specifically, what we have right now is artificial narrow intelligence. So we can build a program that beats a human at Go or chess, or performs a search on nearby restaurants or bars that you might want to go to. But we don't have artificial general intelligence, which is human-level intelligence that can do all of these things and learn completely on its own.
That's quite interesting in the context of the UK at the moment, because I know that Rose Luckin, who's partnered with Pearson previously on an AI for education report, has been developing over time a sort of cognitive assistant for learners called Colin, which I love the kind of very suburban name. So she's at UCL and a sort of expert in machine learning, is potentially remove some of the stressful assessment through continual feedback on how a learner is doing and where they need more support, which I think we're going to get to in the second half of the series with Dr. Kristen, which will be interesting around assessment without tests as well.
That's right. And I believe in one of the other later episodes, we'll have Peter Fultz, one of our brilliant data scientists at Pearson.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've already recorded that episode and it was really insightful. So looking forward to sharing that bit. Okay, so data science and AI, biosyncing. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about that third technology.
Biosyncing is a term you probably have not heard before because I made it up. Couldn't find a term or set of terms that could adequately describe what I was trying to get at, which is the symbiotic relationship between man and machine. It's essentially receiving information from the machine in the form of raw data or nudges that you then respond to. Conversely, the machine receives information from the human either consciously or subconsciously, say through hand gestures or eye tracking, but then also through galvanic skin responses, facial recognition, and heartbeat monitoring. In an ideal biosyncing scenario, the human isn't even aware of this symbiotic relationship.
So this is really interesting because I saw a presentation the other day where essentially what was inferred was that through facial recognition, you may be able to, you know, for example, understand that a student doesn't understand a concept and therefore step back and, you know, make sure you sort of start building that idea again. You know, that obviously there are some tensions there around student data, privacy, sense of self, where the boundary lies. What's your thoughts on all of that? And how do you see biosyncing within an educational context as well?
Certainly, we need to be careful about the information that we're gathering and transparent about what we're doing with it. I understand privacy concerns. I think that as people see the value of sharing this information, they'll be willing to do it and really happy to. Biosyncing monitors not just the user's mental state, but also their physical state, potentially their emotional state. You're going to perform at your best mentally if you are also doing well emotionally and physically.
And how about within an educational context? Are there particular examples of tools or services being developed around this that are currently being used?
This is the third of the four foci that I'm describing, and probably the one that's the least developed. However, it does have a lot of potential. Let's say the learner is in a digital learning experience, and there's a camera on the laptop or the tablet that he or she is using. We could detect if the learner is confused or bored and give them an opportunity to display that they already have mastered the content, and then prompt him or her to demonstrate mastery on the subject matter and progress, or understand that the learner needs further clarification.
Okay, and then last but not least, human-machine relations. So I know this is a subject close to your heart.
Yeah, human-machine relations is probably the most important of the four because it encompasses all of the technologies and all of our interactions with machinery, with robotics, with artificial intelligence. It's about understanding how to work with these technologies to improve our lives individually and society as a whole. It includes maker learning, which at its heart was not just about teaching programming, but also working with physical objects, understanding how things function, and creating. It's a form of constructivism. Another component of human-machine relations is proper digital citizenship and understanding your data. So we discussed earlier some privacy concerns. Human-machine relations includes understanding where your data is stored and how to use it properly.
The episode today is about what does future tech for education look like? We've talked about mixed reality, data science, biosyncing, and human-machine relations. I suppose just following on from that last one on human-machine relations and tech being very much only half the picture, do you have a kind of prevailing philosophy or pedagogy behind using technology that you would encourage educators to think about?
Definitely. So we're seeing the convergence of virtual and physical worlds. And one story that I like to give is of Garry Kasparov, the great human chess player who lost to Deep Blue, which was created by IBM. About 20 years ago, after he lost to that computer program, he realized that he wouldn't be able to compete with that machine going forward. So rather than just giving up, he decided to work with machines. He created a new form of chess called Centaur chess or freestyle chess, in which teams made up of only humans or only algorithms or a combination of the two can compete against each other. Since this form of chess has begun, the world champion is almost always a centaur or a combination of the best a human has to offer, such as creativity, and the best that an algorithm has to offer, which is computation.
That's the centaur part of it. But you have, along with biosyncing, coined your own term. Is that right?
Kasparov refers to the combination of human and machine as a centaur. Well, most centaurs, as we know, were unruly because they were often very violent creatures. And that's certainly a risk when it comes to working with technology. So I don't think that's a good example to set of how we should work with technology. But Chiron, on the other hand, was an educator, was a figure in Greek mythology who was a centaur, but he was very well learned and he was an educator. For example, he taught Achilles. So I think the Chiron mentality is what we should be aspiring to, using technology to help all of society and ourselves individually.
I've definitely had my own violent incidents when using technology.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So final question, really. I think we spoke previously about, I watched the original Blade Runner recently and I was struck. So the film was then set in 2019. And the sort of cityscape of the film was so futuristic. So, you know, very dystopian, very polluted skies, which, you know, perhaps is more realistic than not, but very futuristic buildings and architecture. And yet when they went into the buildings, the physical computers that you saw were very much based around a sort of old school BBC monitor with the green typeface sort of flashing out at you. And it made me realize, you know, where sometimes our forecasts are slightly awry. So the physical aspect was very different, whereas I was watching that film, you know, 1 year away from 2019, essentially, in an Edwardian house. Yet the computers were not ambitious enough and not different enough. So I guess my question was, how can our past hopes and fears for the future, so for example, when the original Blade Runner was put together and, you know, examples before that, help to put everything into perspective for those who might be listening to this series and feeling slightly overwhelmed by change, especially if they're dealing with the very current situation of educating learners every day, day in, day out? So what are your thoughts around the topic of future forecasting in this respect?
Blade Runner, the original Blade Runner, is a great example. Specifically, it's set in 2019 and they're driving flying cars, but nobody has cell phones. Similarly, if you look at Back to the Future Part 2, that time when it took place just recently passed, they got a lot of things right. They're using virtual reality and screens, essentially FaceTiming. But once again, they don't have smartphones. There's a term for this, which is paleofuturism. It's kind of a hobby of mine. Humans are a unique species in that we're the only ones that can really envision the future. But in order to do this, we rely on our experiences and also our memories. There's a wonderful example, a set of postcards from the turn of the century, the last century, in France. Some of these postcards are spot on. There are even people who are FaceTiming, essentially, but all of these devices have wires. That idea that a technology can come around and have such a huge impact on our lives that we didn't even see coming, it's called a black swan. Again, wireless technology, smartphones, all of these things are huge, have huge impact on our lives, but we could not really predict them because they were so unlike anything we've seen in the past.
We've talked about some of those examples of future forecasting. And you talked about the black swans. So previously, it may have been things like smartphones or wireless technology, which we didn't see coming. Do you have an opinion on, you know, some of the black swans of the future? Or by their nature, are they sort of always slightly beyond our grasp?
They're wild cards. So I think I could probably make a lot of money if I could foresee that sort of innovation. A useful tool for future forecasting is called the futures cone. And it also gives you an idea of why it's so difficult to predict the future. The futures cone is on a timeline, obviously. And the farther out you look, the broader the possible outcomes. In that the middle of that futures cone, you have the probable scenario. On the extremes or the outliers, you have the worst case scenario or the best case scenario. The way that our technology develops rarely turns out to be the worst case scenario or the best case scenario, but somewhere in between. Along the way, too, we have these wild cards that change the direction of the future in which we're headed. It's impossible to predict the future exactly, but one thing I can say with certainty is that the future will not be exactly as we imagine it will be.
And so if I'm an educator listening in and I'm interested and excited about using technology, but I'm always going to have a limited amount of time in terms of research of what I should be doing and how it's going to make an impact, where would you advise to spend time if we think about the technologies that are available now, and then how far out should people look? I guess that's also based on their personal interests, but do you have any advice about how to navigate what's coming down the line without feeling overwhelmed?
I advise everybody, educators and learners alike, to try to avoid fear. Fear is not useful. Humans fear what we don't understand, and we don't know how the future is going to unfold. However, humans are also very adaptive creatures. Once we understand how to use something, a technology, or live in an environment, then we thrive. Over the course of history, technology and innovations have significantly helped our lives on an individual and societal level. What I suggest is that everyone employ mindful skepticism. This means not accepting a new technology as inherently good or evil, but try to understand what the possibilities are. Try to understand what can it be used for? How can I make the most of this technology?
So in the next episode of the Future Tech for Education podcast series, we're going to be talking about what is AI and what has it got to do with me and my students. Do you have any thoughts to give people a sneak peek into what we might be discussing there?
Sophie, this was really fun, and thank you for having me on. I'm really excited about the next episode, where we're going to be talking about artificial intelligence or augmented intelligence. And some of your guests, as I know, are going to elaborate on how these technologies can be used in applications that can make our learners' lives better and our educators' lives better.
That's the end of our first episode in this series. Next week, we delve even deeper into the implications of data science for education with the episode, What is AI and What Has It Got to Do with Me and My Students? Want to leave feedback? Tweet us at Podcast EdTech and at Dennis Hurley, that's DennisHurley, or check out the Pearson podcast page at tinyurl.com/PearsonFutureTech, where you can also find more content, reports and insight on everything from parental engagement, open APIs for EdTech developers, or what skills you might need for what jobs by 2030. I'll drop that link, show notes and more at www.theedtechpodcast.com.
Throughout human history, one of our big successes has been the development of more and more technology.
So I'd say the first thing we need to do is shift expectations from mindsets to skill sets.
We are so trained to fear AI.
The AI-based design company seems to be at a distinct disadvantage.
It's so cool that we can get students to engage with computations and so on. What should the humans do versus what should you let technology do?
And that what is an application of skills and knowledge at a moment in time.
They have enormous computing resources and the latest AI technology on their side.
So as educators, we have to stop and say, how do we approach this?
Artificial intelligence is a program or an algorithm that can function like a human.
Their human rivals have all had years of industrial experience designing cars, bikes, and engines.
Everybody's got to be in the learning business.
If you enjoyed the episode and want to hear more on AI, languages, gaming, assessment without tests, and personalized learning, make sure you subscribe to the EdTech Podcast on iTunes, where you can also leave a review. Thanks for listening in, and we look forward to hearing your own future tech for education related stories.